Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Stephanie Sanders has a report on the current atmosphere in the auto industry and how it may affect Louisville's two Ford plants. First, your electricity bill may not be as shocking as your gasoline bill. That's because Kentucky boasts some of the cheapest electricity rates around, thanks to coal. While other states are already using more alternative energy sources, Kentucky faces an energy dilemma. Kristen Espeland reports.
There are two basic sources for generating electricity. One comes from fossil fuels, the other from renewable sources. That's what the elements provide, free of charge. But where those elements, like sun and wind, work their magic varies.
We don't have a whole lot of potential for wind.
Len Peters is Secretary of Kentucky's Energy and Environment Cabinet. When it comes to the potential for generating more electricity from wind, Kentucky just doesn't have the resources a state like Wyoming has, where 60-mile-an-hour winds regularly shoot across the high prairie.
We have some hydro.
But only about 2.5% of the state's electricity comes from hydroelectric dams.
And I believe that as we move forward within Kentucky, we're going to be seeing solar on a much more distributed basis as opposed to baseload generation for electricity.
Translation: solar isn't practical here on a large scale for centralized baseload generation, which means the minimum amount of power required 24 hours a day for utilities' customers. That's partly because Kentucky doesn't receive as much sunlight every year as, say, Arizona. So what does that leave? Not many options. Kentucky's Public Service Commission looked into whether or not Kentucky should mandate that a certain percentage of electricity from all utilities come from renewable sources. It's called a Renewables Portfolio Standard, or RPS, and it's an idea that's gaining popularity and spurring on the development of renewable resources around the country. But the commission's Andrew Melnikovich says Kentucky isn't ready for it.
The commission generally, in reaching its conclusions, found the arguments by the opponents of an RPS target to be fairly persuasive.
The first argument from opponents like electric utilities is that there's not enough renewable energy potential in Kentucky to make those targets. The second, they say, is that new facilities would cost customers more. But Melnikovich says the fact that Kentucky isn't setting a standard for renewable energy sources doesn't mean state officials are turning their backs on their benefits.
We're going to have to diversify in the long run. I mean, I don't think anybody's saying that we're going to be able to be 95% dependent on coal for the indeterminate future.
Kentucky's best option for renewables seems to be biomass, organic materials like the leftovers from corn production, and gas from animal waste. But Kentucky doesn't require that a certain amount of our electricity come from biomass or any other renewable resource, and that puts us in the minority compared to the 29 other states that do have an RPS in place. Illinois has mandated that 25% of its electricity come from renewables by 2025. North Carolina has set a target of over 12% by 2021. There, Utilities Commission attorney Sam Watson says they're concentrating on meeting that target by making the most of what they've got, biomass.
It could be methane projects from swine waste operations, hog lagoons, also biomass from wood waste, poultry, litter, energy crops.
Some of those sources are abundant in Kentucky, too, but Energy Secretary Len Peters says putting a statewide plan in place to take advantage of them will take some time.
We're a brand new cabinet. Governor Beshear put us in place June the 16th. We are trying to certainly make very, very realistic estimates on what might be possible with renewables.
He says the cabinet is currently developing research papers on those possibilities. For WFBL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
As Ford Motor Company struggles to regain its footing in the auto manufacturing industry, Louisvillians are waiting for news about how the city's two Ford plants will fit into the company's future. Stephanie Sanders has more on how Ford's Louisville operations must change to survive.
Gary Sowers has been employed at Ford's Kentucky Truck Plant on Chamberlain Lane in Louisville for 13 years, but he's not working at all this month. The entire plant that makes Super Duty trucks is shut down for July as part of company cutbacks as Ford tries to return to financial solvency. Before that, it was cutting production from 5 days a week to 4 days, and Sauer says rolling layoffs will continue when workers return in August.
It's good they're not indefinitely laying off a bunch of people. You know, they're rotating the layoff because You know, then it keeps the majority of people there working some here and there.
Local United Auto Workers Union President Rocky Comito says the constant shift changes over the last few months have emotionally exhausted the workforce, but they're up to the challenge.
I think that's the biggest thing the Ford Motor Company realizes with the plants here in Louisville, that they want them to stay and they want them to be here because the workforce is so outstanding.
But a great workforce isn't the only piece of a successful car company.
For 33 straight years, Ford's been number one of any type of vehicle sold, has been the F-Series truck. And that's been the toughest hit.
That's Marty Book, the vice president of Carriage Ford in Clarksville. Nationwide, over the last 6 months, sales of Ford F-Series trucks have declined nearly 23%, and Explorer SUV sales are down 33%. 3,600 workers build the F-Series at Kentucky Truck Plant, and another 1,900 build SUVs at Louisville Assembly Plant. While sales of those vehicles were slipping, no doubt in part because of rising gas prices, sales of the smaller, more fuel-efficient Focus increased nearly 28%.
Focus sales obviously has been our staple here lately, and really what's happened with not just Ford, with everybody, it's been cars.
The good news for Louisville is that Ford officials have previously promised to bring production of a new vehicle to Louisville Assembly by 2010. Reporter Amy Wilson has been following the story for Detroit-based Automotive News.
We're hearing from several of our sources that Ford is making plans internally to produce the Focus at the Louisville plant.
Industry analyst David Cole with the Center for Automotive Research says the transition from Explorer to Focus would also have long-term benefits.
What they will do in the conversion of that plant is make it a much more flexible plant that could accommodate a range of vehicles fairly quickly. And that really would be a very important and positive thing for your area.
But the story is a little different at Kentucky Truck Plant. It has received no such promise from the company, and Cole says it's a different ballgame in the pickup truck market. He says although sales are down right now, they could rebound, as trucks are necessary in certain industries, no matter how much gas costs. The risk to Kentucky Truck, says Cole, is the company may have too many factories producing Super Duty trucks for the shrinking market, and some may have to go. He says local leaders should stay ahead of such a scenario.
There's nothing more important, in my judgment, than really a proactive community where you come to Ford and say, we know there's problems, it's a tough time, we're going to do whatever it takes to make sure that we are the location of choice for the Ford Motor Company.
City and state leaders came to the rescue when the Louisville Assembly Plant needed help a few months ago. It was on the brink of closure when a Kentucky delegation traveled to Michigan to offer tax incentives. Ford executives say they'll announce plans in the next few weeks to reconfigure the company's North American operations, and the state's economic development leaders meet at the end of this month to discuss additional incentives to try to entice Ford to consider further investments at the two plants in Louisville. For WFPL, I'm Stephanie Sanders.
Every day, broadcast and print media have a new angle on gas prices, and tomorrow, Louisvillians can see a movie about the issue. The producers and directors of the documentary Gas Hole will be in Louisville to present their film, which they say is a fair and slightly fun look at the history of gasoline, oil, and alternative energy. Gabe Buller talked with Gas Hole's writer, producer, and co-director Jeremy Wagoner about the movie.
Tell me about this movie.
This is a documentary film about the history of oil prices and the future of alternative fuels. It's a project that Scott and I have been working on for, it took us about 2.5 years to get completed. And we're currently on a 43-city tour across the country with the film. And in each of the screenings in each of the cities, Scott and I stick around, and afterwards we do a question and answer because this is such a hot topic and people are so fired up after they see the film that, you know, we'd like to keep the conversation going.
Because fuel prices are such a hot topic, is that why you decided to make the film?
No, actually, we started 2.5 years ago, and what got us into the film is we had seen a letter to the editor, and this was back when gas prices were really outrageous. I think they were $2.20 here in California at the time. But people were angry about it, and even back then. And this senior citizen had written a letter to the editor in the paper out here, and he had recalled that he had met a man in his when he was a teenager in the 40s, And this gentleman had invented a water-injected carburetor and was getting about 100 miles to the gallon. And this guy told him that he had sold his patent to the Shell Oil Company, which made him a millionaire, but that he could never build another one. And so this letter to the editor said, you know, well, whatever happened to that technology? Why don't we have that? And that was such an interesting idea to us that we that was a good question. And, you know, everybody's heard those stories. And so Scott and I thought we would we'd look into it.
Did you find the water-injected carburetor?
We actually found the patent that we believe is the patent that he was referring to.
Would it have worked?
And we took that patent to a mechanical engineer and a guy whose job is to bring patents to market. And he said, yeah, I see exactly how this would work. It makes sense to me. And then beyond that, what was really shocking to us is we actually tracked down a renowned Shell scientist who had edited a book called The Fuel Economy of the Gasoline Engine, in which they, in this book, they describe how they were getting 149 miles on an old Studebaker.
So why aren't we getting, I mean, if a Studebaker's getting triple digits in gas mileage, why am I still getting, you know, 30 on, like, a sedan?
That's the question that we're asking. That's what we want to know, and that's why we made the film, is to say, what are the reasons for that? You know, it's not just that they're evil guys, you know, sitting in boardrooms, you know, trying to ruin society. It's not that. But there are a lot of economic reasons. There are a lot of market forces. I mean, back at that time, in the 40s, you know, gas prices were, you know, 10 cents. And we were exporting oil at the time. So it made business sense, which is good business sense. But now it doesn't. It's, you know, it's really damaging the climate, and it's really hurting Americans.
How'd you go about investigating and putting together, like, compiling the footage for this movie, finding who to interview, basic production?
We were all over the place. The first thing we did after we interviewed the gentleman was to go to Congress and see what was happening there. And we talked to both Democrats and Republicans because it was important to us to get both sides of the issue and present as much of this stuff down the middle. And we had both sides telling us the same thing. One of the things that kind of shocked us is we talked to Sherwood Bullard, who was a Republican and who was the chairman of the Science Committee at the time, and he told us that the National Academy of Science had identified 11 different patents that were on the shelf that could be used right now to increase our fuel economy and that we're not using them. So when you have a Republican telling you that, who's a scientist, it really makes you stop and go, what's wrong? Why aren't we fixing this?
So did you find an answer? Is there a conclusion at the end of the film on as to why?
Well, there's a lot of different reasons. What we found is our summary of the film is our problem with oil dependency is not a technological problem. What our problem is, it's a social problem, it's a political problem, and it's an economic problem. And those are the things that we have to solve to get us out of this mess.
And that's what's found by the end of the film through all your interviews and everything?
Yeah, absolutely, because then one of the things that we also look at, we went back and looked at the Standard Oil Company and the history of where these oil industries came from. You know, one of the things that we didn't realize, that Scott and I didn't know when we started the project, is that all of the top oil companies all used to be part of Standard Oil. When they created the antitrust laws in the United States, which were created to break up Standard Oil, it broke up into Shell, BP, Chevron, Exxon. These are all sister companies. And that was a thing that was kind of shocking and enlightening to us. And then moving forward, we started to look at all the technologies that are viable and technologically available to us right now that we're not pursuing the way we should.
Did you go into this movie with a particular mindset, like oil companies are to blame or anything like that? Like, do you come from a specific side? Did you have an agenda, or were you just going in hoping to have an investigation?
Actually, Scott and I are not documentarians. This is our first documentary. We're from the narrative side, so really we were just looking for an interesting story. And, you know, the thing that always surprises people when they after they meet us and see the film is to realize that we're both registered Republicans. So, you know, for us it was very important to not go into it with a political slant and to not go into it with an agenda. And to be honest, neither one of us really knew much about the topic at all. We just thought it was an engaging story, but the more we looked into it, it just opened so many different doors. And as we pursued it, we were just so shocked about so many different things that, it's really changed our perspective. But our real goal was just to answer the same questions that everybody else has.
Do you think you came out with a political or a partisan film at all?
No, I don't think so. It's not pro big oil, but it is not a Republican film. It's not a Democratic film because, for us, there's not a Republican pump or a Democrat pump. It's all the same pump.
With the title, Gashole, it seems like there might be a little bit of a humor side to it. Is that true?
Yeah, well, absolutely. Like I said, Scott and I are, we're not really from the documentary world, so for us, we just tried to make it as entertaining and engaging a film as possible. Documentaries tend to be a little dry, I think, for my taste. So we just try to keep it as interesting and engaging and as light as possible because, the information by itself is frustrating enough. We don't need to, make it worse.
That was Gabe Bullard talking with Jeremy Wagoner, who's one half of the team behind the documentary film Gashole. Wagoner and his partner will be at the Village 8 Theater tomorrow evening at 7 to present the movie. When we come back, I'll talk with the new executive director of Bernheim Forest. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Robin Fisher talks with author Bill Bishop about his book, The Big Sort. First, the new executive director at Bernheim Forest begins work tomorrow. Mark Warms comes to Kentucky from Pasadena, California, where he was chief executive officer of the Los Angeles County Arboretum and Botanic Garden. He's also a former director of the Kansas City Zoo. I spoke with Warms about his new post overseeing the Bernheim Arboretum and Research Forest, which covers thousands of acres in Bullitt and Nelson counties, and began by asking what attracted him to the job.
Bernheim's a unique opportunity to manage a facility that believes in the blending of science, art, and nature. And the fact that it's a private, not-for-profit organization with 16,000 acres to manage is truly a fabulous situation to build a strong base for a community. For a community outreach program that'll be second to none.
I would think it would be a little difficult to leave Pasadena, California.
Well, there's much to offer in Southern California, and myself and my family loved it there. But I was also born and raised in Dayton, Ohio. And so I spent some of my youth in Louisville and surrounding areas, birding and botanizing and spelunking. And so I kind of knew what I was getting into. Also, Louisville has that sense of community that is very important to me and my family.
Well, you're no stranger to this area.
No, not at all.
I know it's early, but is there anything specific you'd like to do at Bernheim that hasn't been done?
Oh, well, I think it's a strong base to work from. So, I think initially what I'm going to do is learn a lot about the land and the communities. I think that there's some good ties that have been made throughout the community that can be built upon, probably involving, more collaboration throughout Bullitt and Nelson counties and building the relationships, throughout Louisville and Jefferson County. Those are the kinds of things I'm going to concentrate on at first. And probably the idea of really bringing Bernheim to the people so that people know what to expect when they come down and see this, magnificent resource and get excited about it because it's about connecting people with nature.
I grew up in Nelson County, and one of the great things that attracted us to Bernheim was the cost, which is still next to nothing to get in.
Yeah, absolutely true.
You're hoping to keep it that way, but fundraising, of course, is going to be a big part of your job.
Yes, and you know, that's the great part about being in the Midwest. I've always found people to be very generous and interested in great causes, and you know, nature and science, education. Those are, you know, two of the best causes one can think of. And so, you know, I look forward to that challenge.
Is your family excited about moving here?
Oh, very much so. We brought our boys down a few weeks ago. They had an opportunity to catch frogs and some turtles. And so there, you know, what could boys ask for but 16,000 acres, you know, to mess around in? So it's a great opportunity for them.
Great. Well, we look forward to meeting you. And again, congratulations on the new position.
Well, thank you very much. And I look forward to getting to know everybody throughout the community.
That was Mark Warms, the new executive director of the Bernheim Arboretum and Research Forest in Bullitt and Nelson counties. During this election year, it's become fairly apparent that certain neighborhoods in Louisville tend to vote certain ways. But have we always lived close to such like-minded people? Not according to author and Louisville native Bill Bishop. Robin Fisher talked with Bishop about his book, The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart, and what this sorting portends for our future.
Your recent book is entitled The Big Sort, and it puts forth the premise that despite the fact that the U.S. is becoming more diverse, our day-to-day lives are becoming more segregated, and not just racially. And I was just curious how this first came to your attention. Did you all of a sudden look around and think, my neighborhood has all the same political signs?
Well, no, I once I realized that, my neighborhood does have all the same political signs. But we came at this because of, we were looking at economies. I am from Kentucky originally and had been working in Lexington, and especially working a lot in eastern Kentucky and writing a lot about the economy there and why it was lagging. And then I moved to Austin, where the economy wasn't lagging at all. It was just booming. And so I hooked up with a statistician, and we began asking the question about why some places were succeeding economically and other places were slow on the uptake. And what we found was that people were sorting, and that in particular, people with education with BA degrees were clustering in particular places. So Austin was just sopping up people with BA degrees to an extent more so than Louisville or Cincinnati or Dayton or Cleveland, and that was driving the local economy. So we started looking at the sort through the eyes of the economy and how people were moving for economic reasons, not because of politics.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you gathered your data.
Well, we gathered so much data. Bob just gathered. We gathered data from the IRS. We had all the census data. What tipped us off? We gathered a lot of data from that Robert Putnam used in his Bowling Alone books, and we began looking at city economic types through how they answered marketing questions. And we could see that low-tech cities had the different kinds of cultures than high-tech cities. For instance, low-tech cities, people were more apt to go to church and join in civic activities and join clubs. In high-tech cities like Austin, people engaged more in individualistic activities, not as much with families. And at that point, Bob decided to look at election results. So we gathered election results for every presidential election from 48 through 2004, and from that we did calculations on the distribution of votes at the county level, and we could see that from 1976 on, most counties in the United States were tipping, becoming increasingly either Republican or Democratic.
How long do you think, you just said since 1976, but in a way, I mean, it's human nature to sort of gravitate toward your own, so to speak.
Right, and that's what caught our attention, because it's absolutely a survival mechanism to want to be around people who are like you, and so it surprised us to see the numbers increasing. The basic numbers are that in 1976, an extraordinarily close election, about a quarter of the people, voters, lived in a county, in a community that voted either 20%, had a 20% margin of victory for either Jimmy Carter or Gerald Ford. And that increased in close elections in kind of a stair-step fashion until 2004, when about half the people lived in one of these landslide counties. So if it had always been, and it was, has always been human nature to flock together, then why was it increasing? And why, given our incredible choice, were we choosing to live around others who voted like we did?
Well, you know, something that struck me when I was reading the book and then thinking about my own life and experience of those around me is, you know, I suppose it is possible that it is our diversity and our increase in diversity politically, socially, economically, racially, that is causing us to seek out that sameness for comfort. It's sort of I don't want to say backlash, but it's sort of a byproduct of diversity is making us sort of band together.
Yes, I mean it's maybe the confusion of the world that has gotten people more interested in finding comfort in more homogenous groups, and because it wasn't just neighborhoods that were becoming more homogenous, churches were becoming more homogenous. When I grew up, and people would go, especially in Louisville, in the Catholic churches, you were supposed to go into the neighborhood Catholic church, beginning in the 1970s, churches became more tailored and more consumer-oriented for particular lifestyles and beliefs and customs. And so what happened in society is that the meeting ground, the middle, began to disappear. The clubs where people diverse interests would join disappeared, and clubs became, instead of the Rotary or the Rebecca's, you had Sierra Club or environmental groups or groups with a particular political point of view, and so the sorting that we write about in the book cuts across everything, it really is an attempt, as you described, for people to find safety and sort of a cultural comfort in among like-minded others.
But you know, at its basic core, this sorting is un-American. I mean, we've always loved a spirited debate, but if you're just like your neighbor, you're just like your social group, where is the spirited debate on the average level? I mean, has it all moved to the larger arena of the media?
That's where the debate begins and ends, debate implies that you listen to the other side and that you eventually compromise, and that when democracy becomes a consumer item, that's not something we don't compromise on the, you know, the kind of car we buy or the kind of product that we want stuff exactly the way we want our stuff, and we expect democracy to work the same way, and it's not built to work that way. It's built to be discordant and to be troublesome and to demand compromise, and we're just not good at that. Americans, in especially educated Americans, are bad at listening to those who disagree with them.
This book made me think quite a bit about my own life, and I live in a neighborhood where I would say that I do not politically blend with my neighbors, but my social group, we're very like-minded, and part of me wonders if some of that isn't simply because it is easier. You know, it's not as much work if you and your friends are all pretty much on the same page.
Right, and that is true, and that yes. What is interesting to us is that those lifestyle similarities now translate directly into political belief, so that people that have similar ways of life end up having similar politics, and I think that is new, and so that comfort that we find being around those who are like us in a lifestyle sense these days are also that way from a political point of view. And so it's all self-reinforcing, and it becomes this kind of snowball of of conformity and the homogeneity that that rolls up, especially every presidential election.
I would say that that is very true, and it reminds me of a funny conversation that I had with a friend several years ago. He was moving out to Seattle, and he had all of a sudden adopted sort of what I consider to be, at that time, the uniform. And I made the comment to him, so you're going to go out there and wear all black with all the nonconformists.
Right.
And I see Louisville's sort of nonconformist neighborhoods in that conformist vein when it comes election time, because when you drive through the Highlands, a lot of the signs are the same.
Right, and I wasn't around for the John Yarmuth election in 06, right? But
right. Mm-hmm.
From what I read in the Courier, those were the precincts where he won. That he didn't flip Republican precincts, but he got an incredible turnout among in those neighborhoods that were already Democratic. So, and that's what we see nationally, especially in national elections, is that people don't vote as individuals. They're not reflecting an individual opinion as much as they are reflecting the opinion of the group. They're voting for their community. And in 2006, that was especially strong in Louisville in those kinds of nonconformist communities.
So tell me, why do you see this as a bad thing? I mean, we can talk about what's happening, and we can talk about sort of the political or economic segregation, but why, in the end, in an election year, is this a bad thing?
Well, the good part is that people can find the place to live where they're comfortable and where they feel fulfilled. And it's all, the good part is also that the country has this incredible diversity among places. So in Odessa, Texas, in West Texas, they voted to put in a Bible course in their high school, and then in Portland, Oregon, they spent a lot of money on public transportation and on libraries. So that's the good part. The bad part is that as we are increasingly unwilling and unlikely to talk to those who disagree with us, and we live in these communities where we are assured by our neighbors that we are right, we are less willing to compromise, and our representatives in Congress and increasingly in the state legislatures are unwilling to compromise because they represent people who are just absolutely convinced that their way of life is the way to go. And so it makes coming to a consensus on state issues and on national issues just almost impossible. And so Congress is sort of stymied. A lot of state legislatures are stymied because the people who go to those places represent entirely different views of what ought to happen.
It's sort of a chicken and egg thing in a way, because your representative, whether it's federal or state, is reflecting their area, and then in turn, you know, the area is reflecting the views of their representative, and then no one's reaching out.
Right. Right. And because there's no call for them to reach out. If you look at there are people that measure ideology in Congress, and today there is literally no Democrat who is more conservative than the most liberal Republican. There's just no overlap in Congress. And you know, I covered the Kentucky legislature at a time. There were liberal Republicans, and there were Walter Baker, you know, from a Republican senator, was a liberal, and there were then conservative Democrats, and those people have been gradually weeded out of the process as their constituencies have become more ideologically assured of their beliefs.
So, if this continues in the country, how do you see us faring politically?
Well, nationally, we'll have what we have now, which is this a country stymied on the big national issues. Healthcare debates will continue to flounder, and we'll continue not to be able to come to any kind of consensus nationally about national issues. Whereas locally, cities and places where there are strong majorities will take up the slack, and they'll You see cities now having global warming policies and religious policies and gun control policies. And so the real action in government is going to be at the city level rather than the state or the national level.
That was Robin Fisher talking with author and Louisville native Bill Bishop about his current book, The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. Bishop will be reading from and signing copies of his book this afternoon at 4 at Carmichael's Bookstore on Frankfort Avenue. There's more information at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, Elizabeth Kramer reports on the rising popularity of liberal arts degrees. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, I'll talk to a longtime Newsday sports writer about what he calls the 10 moments that shook the sports world. First, the idea that the liberal arts are more important than ever is gaining believers from industry to healthcare to education. One of its staunchest proponents is in Louisville next week to make his case. Elizabeth Kramer has the story.
Daniel Pink's book, A Whole New Mind, depicts American society moving from the technology-focused industrial and information ages to what he says is now upon us, the conceptual age. He argues that to remain competitive in a globalized economy, Americans have to be exceptionally creative and extract ideas from the arts and humanities. The world of business has been operating under this idea for years, but now it is beginning to take root in other areas. At the University of Louisville Hospital, the palliative care team, which includes a chaplain and a counselor, is visiting an 85-year-old woman who's had brain trauma. Dr. Lori Earnshaw talks to the woman and her daughter.
We're just here to see if we can help make you feel better and talk to your daughter about how we can get you help at home and make a plan for the future so you feel prepared.
The team then goes into another room to speak with the daughter. They ask questions about her mother's life, her mobility and health before her accident, her beliefs and her wishes for end-of-life care. They are discerning a story to understand this patient and help the family make difficult decisions. Taking this approach to patient care is particularly innate to Dr. Earnshaw, who earned her undergraduate degree in English.
I just thought that if I was able to just hear people's stories all day long, how neat that would be to actually do something with them and make something positive come of that story. The way that somebody told their story gave you clues to what was really bothering that patient.
Daniel Pink notes the use of stories, a way of using the arts and humanities to better treat patients. Medical students throughout the country are taking classes in the visual arts, literature, and religion. Starting in January, U of L's medical school will require students to take classes in religion, history, and literature, including required readings by Dostoevsky and John Carlos Williams. Pink differentiates between medical schools and elementary and secondary schools.
What's going on in medical schools is as remarkable as what's not going on in elementary and secondary schools is distressing.
Pink says this distressing situation arose during the last 20 years as legislation pushed elementary and secondary schools to focus on the basics and produce concrete results. Often, the methods emphasized rote learning to boost test scores and meant less time for the arts and humanities. Pink says instead of preparing children for the future, schools are educating them for a past economy. Jefferson County Public Schools Superintendent Sheldon Berman says educators throughout the country recognize this, and that is why they have invited Pink to speak at many professional conferences in recent years. Berman says the Jefferson County Public School System has been developing strategies to help schools teach the basics and stir students' creativity to enable them to understand increasingly complex concepts. Sheldon Berman.
We need to move them into a larger context where they begin to see connections between the information that they're receiving. They need to be able to understand the big picture and the social circumstances around it.
Berman and Pink agree that navigating that challenge while meeting the requirements set by legislators is difficult. Daniel Pink explains why.
The people who actually work in the system, the people teaching in the classrooms, the principals of a building, the superintendents who run the system, they don't set the rules. The legislators set the rules.
Many of those rules probably won't change in the near future. Congress has yet to reauthorize the No Child Left Behind Act,
likely leaving the issue to the next president. And a recent poll shows Americans increasingly concerned about the current economy and less about education. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
Stan Isaacs has been a sports writer and columnist for more than 50 years. He spent much of his career at Newsday, based in Long Island, New York, and covered many of the 20th century's historic sporting events. Isaacs provides an eyewitness account of some of those events in his new book, 10 Moments That Shook the Sports World. I spoke with Isaacs about the book and his career. Well, since we are in Louisville, I better start with the Ollie Frazier bout that
right.
We talk about in the book. Now, which fight was this?
First one,
and that was
1971.
What happened that impressed you?
Well, it was a tumultuous event. Everybody, it was beyond sports because of Ali, who was a worldwide figure. Not only was he a fighter, but he was a political figure. And the fight, from a boxing standpoint, this is the first time you ever had two undefeated guys fighting for the heavyweight championship. So Madison Square Garden was alive. It was electric. You had celebrities all over the place. It dominated the town, dominated New York, and I suppose the rest of the country. And Ali was a magical figure. Everything about him was either controversial or glamorous. And the question of could he come back from a long layoff, they took the title away from him, against a good fighter, a terrific fighter, Joe Frazier. And that made it for quite a dramatic event going in, and it turned out it was a terrific fight. In the book, the one thing about it was, I remember, look back, was my scoring would be considered controversial, and if people read it, they might have a different opinion. But that's in the chapter.
Did you cover any other of Ali's fights?
I covered a lot of his early fights. When I covered the two Sonny Liston fights, and Doug Jones at the Garden, and Cleveland Williams in Houston. Those are the ones that come to mind.
I see.
Yeah. And he was a sensational guy, not only as a fighter, but as a person. He lit up the sky with his poems. People said, he probably didn't write the poems, but he did. He had. I remember that Ira Burkow, who was a columnist for the Times, was interviewing Ali, and for some reason, in the middle of the interview, he said, I have these two nephews, and I'd like you to autograph something. And he told them, their mother says they don't clean up their rooms. So Ali wrote, I'm trying to remember. He wrote a little poem, clean up your rooms or I'll get you, something like that. And so then Burkow thought he would test it with Frazier. Told him the same thing, and Frazier said, all boys are not neat. And that was his answer. Frazier was, solid, and Ali was just as always coming up with something unusual.
Must have been a lot of fun to cover that.
Yeah, it was exciting. Anything with Ali was exciting.
We're talking with Stan Isaacs, author of the new book, 10 Moments That Shook the Sports World. Now, you mentioned a couple of Super Bowls in your book as well, including the first one.
The first one was Green Bay beating Kansas City. Second one was the Jets upsetting the Colts in the third Super Bowl in 1969.
Now, was that the game where Joe Namath guaranteed victory?
That was the one. In those days, because the Jets were ridiculed at some party, and he had a glass of scotch in his hand, he was ridiculed so much he got tired of it, and he said, we have a good team, and we'll beat them, and I guarantee it. So that, and then he came through and did what he said. Since then, it's become a cliche. A lot of guys guarantee, and really it doesn't matter whether they're right or wrong. It's no longer as original as it was with Namath. Wait a minute. I want to go back to the poem that Ali wrote.
Oh, okay.
The kids. He said, to Timmy and Ricky from Muhammad Ali, clean up that room or I will seal your doom.
That's great.
That's him.
I noticed also on your list the Harvard-Yale game, a football game, 1968
is right.
What does that one stick out for you?
Well, because it was an extraordinary game, it was two Harvard and Yale go back to the beginning of football, and great rivalry, the beginning of football. It isn't today, it's not significant on a national level because they have more reasonable academic programs and they don't have semi-professionals playing. But in 1968, they both came, first time two undefeated teams came in for an Ivy League championship, last game of the year, what is always called the game. And Yale had Brian Dowling, quarterback. He's the model for the character B.D. in the comic strip Doonesbury. And they had Calvin Hill, terrific back, who became, you know, went into the pros and was an outstanding player in Dallas. Yale was favored, and Yale dominated the game and was winning fairly big. I think it was by 10 points. And in the last 2 minutes or so, Harvard came from nowhere with all sorts of heroics to tie the game on the last second and then get the winning extra point to tie it. And the Harvard kids went crazy on the field. And the other aspect of it was considered a Harvard victory, even though it was a tie. So the Harvard newspaper, the Crimson, came out 2 days later and said, the headline read, Harvard beats Yale 29-29.
That's great.
It's probably the most famous college newspaper headline in history.
That's good. Now, you were also in Munich for the 72 Olympics, correct?
Yeah, that was the worst event I or probably anybody else ever covered. It was because of such a tragedy of the terrorists killing the Israeli hostages.
Where were you when all this happened?
Well, I got up in the morning, came down out of my room to the press center about 8 o'clock, and we were told about the hostage situation. So I ran to a gate, which was outside the Olympic athletes' compound. We weren't allowed in, but there was a soccer goalie, Shep Messing, an American team who was from Long Island, who I knew. And he served as a messenger for me, running back into the village, talking, finding out what was happening, what he saw, telling me. Then I would go back to the press center, make sure that I was getting everything there, and then back to the gate. So that's where I was covered it. It was frenetic and frantic. And then in the evening, in the darkness, we were getting reports out of the press center about the terrorists taking the hostages out to the airport, out of town, hoping to escape. But that didn't happen. An attempt to ambush them failed, and they shot up all the hostages, 11 in all, died. Two in the apartment when they first rushed the compound, and 9 at the airport. It was awful, and the worst thing was hearing at one time that they were all saved. So it was great relief. We were so happy about it, and then a few minutes later we heard, no, they had all died. Oh, it was obviously the worst event I ever covered, and looking at the list, it's the only downer of the list.
I always remember Jim McCabe coming on the air and with those terrible words, you know, that they're all gone.
Yeah, people remember that. Yeah. I couldn't hear McCabe because we were there. What we could see was German television. It was only coming back to the United States that we were aware of McCabe, and it's no surprise. McCabe was a classy guy, didn't have an ego like some other sportscasters, and did do a terrific job.
You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Heldet. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.